Today is Friday, March 9th. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Iqbal Ahmed. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia, to the UBC campus, to residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our news and podcasts on our website, citr.ca.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Good evening. It is 5:02 p.m. and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover news from the UBC campus, local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. Today we will be interviewing Dr. David Edgington, an associate professor at the Department of Geography here at UBC, who is an expert on the post-earthquake efforts in the devastated regions of Japan. He will be talking to us about the current state of relief efforts and the lessons learned from that disaster. Also today, we will interview Dr. Hani Faris, who will be talking to us about the complex international standoff between Israel and Iran.
All this plus your weekend weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent news, and now for your UBC campus headlines, as well as your provincial news.
In campus news, UBC is seriously considering changing its admissions criteria for in-province applicants because BC teachers are not issuing interim report cards, leaving current grade 12 students without any interim grades to apply with. To avoid stalling the admissions process, UBC is looking to substitute marks from parallel grade 11 courses if interim grade 12 marks are unavailable for in-province applicants. For example, if a grade 12 history mark is unavailable, a grade 11 history course would be used. While UBC considers some grade 11 marks from out-of-province and international applicants, BC students have had to rely on marks from their senior year for admittance. UBC typically relies on report cards issued in March or April to help determine early admissions. Ultimately, UBC wants to match its competitors who already rely on grade 11 marks for applications, as waiting until the ministry database can provide marks in May is often too late. The policy was adopted by UBC Okanagan last week and requires Senate approval before being applied to the Vancouver campus next week.
Police were roaming campus yesterday, asking students to help identify suspects from the June 2011 Stanley Cup riots. This is the second round of suspects for which the Vancouver Police Department has issued wanted posters. Out of the 70 suspects presented in the first round, 25 were identified through the campaign. There are 300 volunteers handing out 70,000 posters across the Lower Mainland today, with 10 volunteer police officers dispatched at the University of British Columbia. Police have also been sent to Douglas College and Longueira College.
In provincial news, the BC Teachers Federation, or the BCTF, President Susan Lambert said that the union's executive is currently drafting an action plan that will be presented to the membership at the BCTF's annual general meeting in Vancouver on March 17th to 20th. Lambert said that, quote, "we'll present members with a whole range of options," end quote, also saying that she doesn't know what will be in the action plan yet, but, quote, "we are constantly making additions and subtractions to it," end quote. The BC Teachers Federation has said it will not comply with Bill 22, which intends to legislate a six-month contract extension on teachers and appoint a mediator. The union also alleges that the bill could strip significant collective bargaining rights from the BCTF. Bill 22 is expected to be passed next week. The union still has permission to walk out and strike once next week under a labor relations board meeting, but it must give 2 days' notice. On Wednesday, the last of the three legal strike days this week, thousands of teachers, union supporters, parents, and students rallied outside the Vancouver Art Gallery to throw their support behind the BC Teachers Federation. Susan Lambert said no decision has been made on next week's strike, but pointed out that spring break starts next week in parts of the province, so a third of the teachers won't be in school anyways.
Opponents of smart meters in British Columbia have suffered defeat in their attempts to block BC Hydro from installing the devices. Hydro says the BC Utilities Commission has dismissed an application from an anti-meter group for an injunction against the program, ruling the technology does not exceed the authority of the province's Clean Energy Act. Hydro says it's now installed almost 900,000 smart meters, just under half of the provincial total, with more than 99% of customers accepting the devices. Opponents claim the meters emit harmful radiation when they broadcast electrical usage data and can be used to spy on people's power consumption. But Hydro insists the meters are safe, sending data for only 1 minute a day, and will eventually make it possible for customers to save money by tracking and managing their own power use. Hydro also says the meters will help in restoring power outages by alerting the utility about areas where electricity might be knocked out.
The BC government will cut funding for post-secondary education by $70 million over the next 3 years. This represents a 2.2% decrease of the government's contribution to the sector. According to Finance Minister Kevin Falcon, the government expects this money to come from administrative savings. In his budget announcement, the minister said, quote, "The province will work with universities, colleges, and other institutions to ensure that frontline programs are not affected," end quote. The minister claimed that a 1% cost reduction is achievable and that post-secondary institutes can find savings by combining purchases of equipment, cutting travel costs, and reducing support services. A statement from the Ministry of Advanced Education emphasized that the budget also included a $9 million increase for, quote, "additional medical, health, and other priority seats," end quote, and that $42 million had been set aside for capital projects over the next few years. Several politicians have voiced their opposition to this part of the budget announcement. Michelle Mungall, the NDP critic for advanced education, said that despite the government's promises, the funding cut is likely to affect students. She argued that institutions have been cutting back on administration for years and that there remains little left to cut.
BC's unemployment rate stayed locked at 6.9% in February, while gaining 9,100 jobs over the previous month, Statistics Canada said Friday. The increase in unemployment has matched by an expansion of the labor pool as more people sought work. Full-time employment increased by nearly 22,000 jobs, but the surge was tempered by a loss of roughly 13,000 part-time positions, a reversal from what happened in January. Canada's economy lost a surprising 2,800 jobs overall, while the unemployment rate declined to 7.4% as fewer people across the country sought work.
The Canadian Avalanche Centre issued today what it calls a special public avalanche warning for recreational backcountry users. The warning includes the mountains of the south coast inland, the Columbia Mountains from near Prince George in the north to the U.S. border in the south, and B.C.'s South Rockies, and is in effect all weekend, the centre said. The centre is advising all recreational backcountry users to carefully monitor avalanche bulletins and be equipped with a shovel, probe, and transceiver. Tim Jones of North Shore Rescue warns skiers and snowboarders who venture out of bounds when avalanche risks are high that they shouldn't count on immediate rescue if there is an avalanche because crews may not be able to safely reach him. Those are your campus and provincial headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick break, but stay tuned for your national and international news right here on News 101.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts downtown at
212 Productions, Beat Street Records, Blim, Dream Apparel, The Fall Tattooing, The Kiss Store, Heart and Soul Clothing Inc., Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinema Tech, Project Space, Scratch Records, Vinyl Records, Woo Vintage, The Zoo Shop, and Across the Bridge, North Vancouver Music Gallery.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
Any UBC student knows that the year begins optimistically.
In your arms tonight.
But by the end of it, you're ready for a little.
Any smart UBC student will therefore know that it's best to get your tickets early to the annual AMS Block Party, featuring Mother Mother, Mastercraft, DJ Headspin, the Boom Booms, and more. Thursday, April 5th on the McInnes Field, your AMS brings you the fifth year of music, partying, and hopefully some sunshine. Early bird tickets available at the Outpost until March 9th, and general tickets available thereafter. For more info, search for the AMS Block Party on Facebook. The fifth annual AMS Block Party is proudly sponsored by CITR.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Iqbal Ahmed.
And I'm Claire Eagle. It's now time for your international news. We go now to an interview with Dr. Hani Faris, who is the head of the U.S.-based Trans-Arab Research Institute, for more insight into the escalating tensions between Iran and Israel. So, Dr. Faris, welcome to the show.
Hello, Claire. Hi, Iqbal.
So, we know that Iran and Israel have definitely been in the headlines a lot more than usual lately, and we've seen those tensions really escalating between the two. Can you give us just, I guess, a bit of background into what we're seeing and why it's relevant for our listeners here?
Well, the animosity between Iraq and Israel started with the outbreak of the Muslim Revolution in Iran in 78. Prior to that, the royal house of the Pahlavis in Iran were very close allies of Israel. But the Islamic Revolution actually took a very hostile position vis-a-vis Israel and became supportive, a strong supporter of the Palestinian population. Through time, the Iranians have supported organizations in the Middle East and regimes in the Middle East that were hostile to Israel. And meanwhile, Israel has done the same, allying itself against regimes or organizations that were allied with Iran. This hostile relationship took a very ominous turn in the last few years with the rise of the issue of the nuclear program of Iran. The Israelis claim that the Iranian nuclear program represents an existential threat to Israel. Mm. The Iranians have continuously said that what we're doing is within our right and which is allowed by international organizations. Namely, we are using nuclear power to generate power and be able to use it in medical research. The Israelis are saying that the Iranians are hiding their true intent to weaponize a nuclear power, and this is basically the issue that is now being discussed internationally, and in which the international community, including Western Europe and the U.S., are heavily involved. And as you mentioned, this has become a major issue in the last few months. And if it continues to evolve in the manner that it is, it threatens the stability of the whole Middle Eastern region and could have also repercussions on the international stage. So it's something that we should all watch very, very carefully and closely, because we all will be one way or the other affected by it.
One of the things that you hear a lot in the news lately, at least coming from kind of the Netanyahu government, is that they indicate that they would be willing to make a first strike against Iranian nuclear facilities. Do you believe that this is an actual legitimate threat that Israel is making towards Iran, or is...
It's an actual threat, but it's not an actual legitimate threat, and it can't be legitimate. International law and the international system does not allow states on their own, unless attacked, to attack other countries. And what the Israelis are doing is against international law. But, and is non-acceptable except for the support that it gets from its ally, the United States of America. But otherwise, no, in terms of legal or moral issues, the threat is not legal. However, will it occur? Yes, there is a possibility that the Israelis might go that route. They've done it twice with in the case of Iraq with the Oz-Iraq nuclear reactor that was supplied by the French, and supposedly for an empty installation in northern Syria, which they hit 2 years ago and claimed that it is a north a Syrian North Vietnamese attempt to build a nuclear reactor. But whatever it may be, in both events, Iraq and Syria, there was no indication whatsoever that that was a nuclear weaponization program. And neither is there any indication in Iran that Iran is involved in a weaponization program in the nuclear field. Iran has consistently said, and so far there is no evidence to the contrary, that this program is non-military. Mm-hmm. Now, the Israelis are saying that we reserve the option to take such measures, such drastic measures, because it affects our future. Well, it affects everybody's future if they do take such drastic measures without proof. Mm-hmm. And this proof cannot be simply hearsay. As you know, in the case of the United States, there has been two national intelligence estimates, which means that all the intelligence services of the United States, some 15 of them, have in the past 2 years submitted intelligence reports to the president, both of which said there is no evidence of weaponization, nuclear weaponization in Iran. So we still have no evidence, and that comes from the U.S. itself, the ally of Israel. Mm-hmm. Yet, Israel continues to threaten, and the demands that they are making are almost impossible to meet.
Speaking of the United States, after the recent what do they call it, the Cablegate, the WikiLeaks, there was some evidence that came out that Israel had given previous thought to attacking Iran nuclear facilities. And on some level, U.S. intervention might have stopped it. Do you think if they would go ahead with these sort of plans again, would they consult the United States, or would they just act unilaterally?
They already said that they might not advise the U.S., and if they do advise the U.S., it'll be they'll give it only a very, very short span of time. But is that the issue? The issue is that Israel is military and military hardware is totally dependent on the United States. It all comes from the U.S. and is based on U.S. technology. And the U.S. is a supporter of Israel, not just diplomatically and politically and economically, but also militarily. And the U.S. can, if it decides to stop Israel from attacking Iran, it has the capability to do it. You know, there is some almost 1,500 kilometers between Tel Aviv and Tehran. And for any Iranian aerial formation, to hit Iranian installations, it would have to cross 1,500 kilometers over several Middle Eastern countries, either be Saudi Arabia or Jordan or Syria or Turkey or Iraq or United Arab Emirates. For it to cross the airspace of any of these countries, the U.S. has the capability to detect that and stop such a move if it decides to. But so far, given the weakness of the American President Obama, and more and more we see him always backing out of a confrontation, and the fact that in November there are U.S. elections, and he's fearsome of the Israeli lobby and of losing Jewish support and Jewish votes, What you see now is that he is backing out, and the only difference between the two positions seems to me to be a difference on timing. Both are saying we'll hit Iran if it's weaponizing nuclear power that it has. But the difference is that the Israelis want to go ahead now. They don't want to wait until it's weaponized. What they're saying is it's enough that it has the know-how, and that's sufficient for us to go and hit Iran. Mm-hmm. Whereas the U.S. is saying, no, we need to know that they have the intent to weaponize, and then we will hit them. Meanwhile, we will simply use diplomatic means to suffocate Iran financially and mm-hmm. economically.
And speaking of Israeli attacks, how do you believe that Israel's nuclear capabilities, although they're undeclared, I think it's kind of common knowledge that Israel does possess nuclear weapons. How does the fact that Israel is a nuclear armed nation play into the relation between them and Iran?
Iqbal, that's the joke. I mean, it makes one become very cynical of international politics when he listens to world leaders talking about and rationalizing their policies. The United States has more than 5,000 nuclear heads in its stock. The Israelis have between 200 and 300 nuclear heads in their stock, one of the largest in the world. And they both have the capability to destroy the human race with 200 nuclear bombs or 5,000 nuclear bombs. They can do extreme damage to the planet and to the human race. And yet, even in the worst of cases, knowing what the Iranians have in terms of enriched uranium, mm-hmm. we know that the most they are capable, if they decide to weaponize, is to have 2 to 3 nuclear heads. Now, you know, this is a society, Iran, of some 78 million people. Mm-hmm. Israel is about 7.8 million people. Iran is more than 10 times the population. And Iran is a country which is a few thousand years old. It's an ancient society. Mm-hmm. And Iran has not been involved in any aggressive wars in its modern history in the 20th century and 21st centuries. And I don't think the Iranians are suicidal and would want to try anything of the sort and then simply be wiped out from the map. It seems to me that the actual reasons why the Israelis, with American support, are doing it, it's because they want to maintain monopoly on the mm-hmm. nuclear weaponry and know-how of nuclear warfare and nuclear weapons in the Middle Eastern region. Mm-hmm. This is one. And second, Iran has been supportive of countries and of organizations that are hostile to Israel. Mm-hmm. So the Israelis feel if they can destroy Iranian installations and undercut the Iranian leadership, that they might provoke the population to move against the leadership and change the regime in Iran. And what they're doing is actually playing a very, very dangerous role.
And I'd one last question, just out of curiosity. Another major U.S., I guess, ally in the Middle East is Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia and Iranian relations are not the best either. How do you feel that Saudi Arabia's role as another major power in the Middle East plays into the relations between Iran and Israel?
It seems to me, Iqbal, that nowadays what we're really seeing is a fight, a clash for the future of the Middle East, mm-hmm. how to control the whole Middle East, and whether that Middle East, the primary power will be Iran and its allies, or will be the United States and its allies in the region. So whether it is the question of Palestine, or the question of Syria, or the question of Iran, or the question of Iraq, the issue is not so much questions of a nuclear power as much as it is who is going to control the destiny of this region, which is one of the most critical areas in the world today, producing something like 55% of the world's production of oil, and has an, proven reserves of over 60% of the world's reserves of oil, not to mention the unproven reserves. So it is an extremely important and strategic region. And what's happening now is an attempt to control this region by two factions. And the Israeli game, as well as the Arab American game, must be understood within that framework.
Professor, I just wanted to ask you, this is Chirag, the producer. I just wanted to ask you one question on, speaking of the American game, I think one of their main games is to provide multi-billion dollar arms deals with countries neighboring Iran. Have you heard about these lately?
It's not lately. This has been on for several decades now. The Middle Eastern region, especially the Gulf region, is a major buyer of weaponry from the United States, and actually gives a great support to the military industrial complex in the States through its purchases of American weapon systems. The unfortunate thing, they don't have the means to deploy and to use the kind of systems, sophisticated systems, that they buy. So you will find that in the case of Saudi Arabia, although they bought the AWACS planes quite some time ago, the AWACS planes are actually piloted and managed by American pilots, and the Americans utilize all the information derived from these planes, which supposedly belong to Saudi Arabia. Right. The Gulf countries are very, very rich in cash, and that comes from oil. And oil now is over $100 a barrel. You can imagine the amount of cash that has piled up in their hands. Right. And one way to use that cash is to have them buy weapon systems in the billions of dollars, as they are doing year after year.
Okay, thank you very much for the interview, Dr. Faris. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and I just want to thank you once again for a very insightful.
Thank you, Iqbal, and thank you, Claire.
Thank you.
Take care, bye.
Goodbye. And thank you, Dr. Faris, once again for that interview on the current Iranian-Israel relations. That was Dr. Faris from the U.S.-based Trans-Arab Research Institute. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. We're going to take a quick PSA, but please stay with us.
The alphabet has only 26 letters. With these 26 magic symbols, however, millions of words are written every day.
This month in Discorder, this month's cover features the experimental punk band Shearing Pinks, three dudes who have been an underground Vancouver staple since 2005 and have over 50 releases, big and small, under their belts. Also featured this month are The Bleeding Hearts, who released their debut EP this month, a review on Wim Wenders' latest film, the 3D dance epic Pina, an update on the Rio's ongoing battle to show movies and serve liquor, not to mention a bunch of excellent show and album reviews, and all of your regular features. Pick up your beautiful and free copy of Discorder at any Friends of CITR business, or if you've gone paperless, don't forget to check out Discorder at discorder.ca. Discorder, that magazine from CITR, supporting local music for over 25 years.
And welcome back to CITR News 101 right here on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm Claire Eagle, and we are joined in studio now by the one and only Phil Chang from the UBC Storm Club for our weekend weather forecast. So Phil, what do we have in store for us?
All right. Thank you, Claire. And good evening, listeners. Lots of rainfall in store for us this coming weekend. For starters, there are three inbound precipitation masses that can be seen on the GFS within the next 72 hours, each threatening to dump 5 to 55 millimeters of precip on us. On top of that, looking at the cloud cover forecast from our UBC's very own Geophysical Disaster Computational Fluid Dynamics Center, there will be an uninterrupted cloud cover on all three high categories. so there is a little chance for sun to shine through. Finally, atmospheric temperature soundings show converging temperatures and dew point lines, meaning it is currently very easy for moist air to condense into liquid water droplets. In conclusion, many things point to a gloomy weekend full of moisture, so I urge you all to dress accordingly. All that said, here's your 3-day weekend weather forecast for UBC. Tonight, cloudy overcast with showers. High of 9, low of 3. Saturday, 40% chance of showers in the morning and rain in the afternoon. High of 8, low of 5. Sunday has a 90% chance of showers, high of 6, low of 3. So that's your weekend weather forecast for UBC, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. Currently, it is around 5 degrees on UBC campus. I'm in the sub with Iqbal, Claire, and CJ. For News 101, I'm Phil Chang.
And thank you so much, Phil, for that our weekend weather forecast. It's always great to have you here in studio. So now we are going to take a quick break, but we will be right back with your national news.
CITR is proud to present Cab Calloway, Ray Charles, Aretha Franklin, and guests live at the Norm Theater. Okay, maybe not live, but nonetheless, it's a Blues Brothers beer garden, and it's going down March 16th in the Norm Theater in the Sub. Join Jake and Elwood Blues on their mission from God March 16th with CITR DJ spinning and cheap beer flowing.
It's 106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark and we're wearing sunglasses. Hit it.
Music, the art of sound and time. Waste, to cause to lose energy, strength, or vigor. Music Waste, Vancouver's annual independent cultural festival, accepting submissions until March 31st. The festival will run from June 7th through the 10th at venues across East Vancouver and, as always, will focus on the city's more innovative and genre-defying music. Don't forget to also mark your calendars for a fundraiser planned for April 6th at the Astoria Hotel. To submit to become a part of Music Waste, just visit musicwaste.ca.
You got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, Bunk?
Your neighborhood indie theater that promotes all things cool.
Fear not, the Rio lives on. This March at the Rio. Catch The Bad Plus live Friday, March 9th at 7 p.m. sharp. From the 10th through the 13th, don't miss People of a Feather. Featuring groundbreaking footage from 7 winters spent in the Arctic, People of a Feather takes you through time into the world of Inuit on the Belcher Islands in Hudson Bay. This film connects the past, present, and future within the unique cultural relationship between the Inuit and the Eider Duck. Wednesday, March 14th at the Rio, it's the Evil Bastard Karaoke Experience at 8 p.m. Thursday, March 15th, it's a live show with Patrick Maliha presenting the Legion of Stand-Up Comedians. For more of what's playing at the Rio Theater, visit riotheater.ca/schedule. To join the community fight back for the rights of the Rio Theater, visit facebook.com and search Rio Theater. Any UBC student knows that the year begins optimistically.
In your arms tonight.
But by the end of it, you're ready for a little. Any smart UBC student will therefore know that it's best to get your tickets early to the annual AMS Block Party, featuring Mother Mother, Masterpack, DJ Headspin, The Boom Booms, and more. Thursday, April 5th on the McInnes Field, your AMS brings you the fifth year of music, partying, and hopefully some sunshine. Early bird tickets available at the Outpost until March 9th, and general tickets available thereafter. For more info, search for the AMS Block Party on Facebook. The fifth annual AMS Block Party is proudly sponsored by CITR.
Welcome back to CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to News 101. And next on News 101, we go an interview with Dr. David Eddington, an associate professor at the Department of Geology here at the University of British Columbia. He is an expert on the post-earthquake efforts in the devastated regions of Japan. Hello, Dr. Eddington.
Hello, Claire. How are you?
Oh, sorry, that was Iqbal you're talking to, but I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Oh, pretty good today.
So we wanted to just chat a bit about Japan. I mean, obviously now it is 1 year after that devastating earthquake, and I think there's still a lot of, it seems at least there's still a lot of confusion about like the relief efforts and rebuilding. And could you just give us an update on the reconstruction efforts and how they're going along right now?
I think everything's going to plan, Claire. There were an awful lot of people perished in the tsunami. The earthquake didn't cause so many deaths. So it's about 99% of all deaths were through the inundation of the huge waves along a 300-kilometer coastline in northeast Japan, about 700 kilometers north of Tokyo. But as of this month, March, about 100,000 people are in so-called temporary housing. So because their homes were destroyed, the national government provides housing for free for about 2 years. Within the next 2 years, many small communities, and these would be typically fishing villages along the coastline, will have to arrange a reconstruction plan for the people in temporary housing. And when those construction plans are agreed to by the national government, then they'll be funded, and then more permanent settlements will be constructed.
And what kind of life are we seeing in these temporary communities right now? I mean, obviously there's a great deal of instability for individuals with that, but I mean, now that it's been a year later, is there a real sense of community that's being fostered there, or is it still very temporary?
Yeah, it's uncertain. You can perhaps imagine, Claire, Japan is a country with a lot of people, but not much usable land. It's very mountainous, about 80% mountains. So finding any spare land very quickly for a large number of displaced people has been a huge problem. But having said that, I mean, the earthquake took place in March. By August, 5 months later, all of the temporary accommodation had been secured and built. The problem is that many people are living far away from shops and schools and their traditional community centers.
What kind of comment can you make for us just on the state of, I guess, the nuclear fallout of it? I know especially here that's something we hear a lot about of criticism for the government and just sort of not really communicating the information to the citizens about the nuclear fallout and just the treatment of that. How do you see that?
Well, you can go online and see real live radiation data for the whole of Japan. But that was put in operation very soon after the earthquake and catastrophe. The puzzle is that around the 25-kilometer evacuation area, nobody is living there at the moment, and the soil is very contaminated. So Japan is learning, because no other country has had to deal with this, to decontaminate the soil, which means scraping about 5 to 10 centimeters of all the ground earth in such a wide area. Yeah. And of course, that's going to take months, if not years, and it will be that time before, if at all, people can return to the area immediately around the stricken nuclear power plant in Fukushima.
And in general, for Japan's nuclear future, what can we expect to see? I mean, obviously, this was such a terrible disaster. Can we expect to see the growth of their nuclear program again in the future?
Well, I don't think there'll be a business as usual. But before March last year, Japan, which always has been very vulnerable to energy shortages, is a country with a very large industrial output, but almost none of the natural resources that we take for granted here in Canada. Nuclear power was about 30% of basic energy supply, and there was a plan to grow that to 50%. This year, 2012, there's a very vibrant debate about what Japan's energy future should be. My guess is that this country will go the way of France rather than Germany. I just can't see that nuclear power won't be part of Japan's energy future. The interesting programs of alternative energy are being discussed, but as we know, these are very expensive alternatives.
Of course. Just going back to what you had mentioned about how they're trying to remove 5 to 10 centimeters in that entire area of the soil, what does that mean for the vegetation? I mean, are they going to remove all the vegetation, all the trees and so on as well? And
that's correct.
Okay. And yep. I guess, what kind of impact is that going to have then on the area?
We don't know.
Okay. Because it's all very much
it's
up
It's going to be a long period of time before we can understand how the area will spring back, if at all. My guess is that some areas will unable to be farmed or inhabited for the foreseeable future.
Definitely. Well, I know we've also heard a great deal about debris that was supposed to be heading, I guess, towards us over the Pacific Ocean. I know we heard a lot about that, especially last year and over the summer and so on, and that seems to have died down a little bit. Is that still something that we should be watching out for? Is that still out there?
My friends who monitor this say that, yes, the debris is moving towards the West Coast. People are picking up all kinds of objects around Hawaii. So over the spring and summer, certainly in British Columbia, Washington State, Oregon, California, that there will be tons of debris. And I guess it's the real challenge of how to deal with that.
And just one last question, just overall looking at, I guess, the international community's response. I know that right after the tsunami, of course, there was such a huge push from the international community to really be there and, I guess, support Japan and try and help with those reconstruction efforts. What kind of international presence are we still seeing there now? Has it been kind of a media burnout where there's not so much interest, or do you think there's still a lot of support internationally?
Well, I know my friends in the Canadian embassy, they organize events up in the north, the Tohoku region of Japan, where the catastrophe occurred, and they try to make Canada's presence known by going into the villages and communities and organizing cook-ups and trying to say, well, Canada's a long-term friend and we're here for your support.
Yeah. Well, great. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. It was really great to get your insight into this.
Thank you very much, Claire. All the best.
All right. To you too. Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye. So that was Dr. David Edgington from UBC's Department of Geography, just talking to us a bit about the reconstruction efforts in Japan and what we can expect to see from the future for that. We're going to go right into our national headlines now, without a break, because we feel like we've given you enough of a break already. So without further ado, it's now time for the national news. The federal government is expected to deliver back-to-work legislation early next week on Air Canada's contract disputes as a precautionary measure to ensure Air Canada's flight schedule is protected from disruptions by the airline's employees. Industry observers say that the move is being made to prevent Air Canada employees from walking off their job. Members of the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers had planned to begin their strike at 12:01 a.m. Eastern Time on Monday, while the pilots' union faced being frozen out the same day. As part of this legislation, Labor Minister Lisa Raitt asked the Labor Board to determine exactly what level of operations Air Canada would need to maintain to avoid posing a danger to the health and safety of Canadian citizens, a point that is key when developing back-to-work legislation. A work stoppage would have created chaos for travelers booked on Air Canada, which expects to carry more than 100,000 per day over the next 2 weeks.
The House of Commons Ethics Committee has decided to hear from Adam Carell, the staff member who is behind the tweeting of Minister Vic Tave's personal details in the so-called WikiLeaks scandal. However, Carell is currently ill, so it may be some time before he can appear before the committee. The Conservatives are determined to hear from the man who resigned from his job at the Liberal Research Bureau after an investigation by the House of Commons linked him to the WikiLeaks 30 Twitter feed. The committee is trying to look into who else may have been behind the campaign.
And those were your national headlines. It is now time for your international headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. In El Salvador this weekend, residents will go to the polls for national elections. The country is voting for the first time following new electoral reforms. From the capital, FSRN's Corey Fisher-Hoffman reports.
This Sunday, March 11th, every seat in the national legislature will be up for election. Voters will use a colorful ballot that includes individual candidates. Before election reforms, voters were only allowed to choose political parties. In addition, the reforms aimed at increasing participation will allow residents of 9 provinces to vote closer to home. This is the first time since former rebel group FMLN signed peace accords that they are not running as the opposition party. Salvadoran President Mauricio Funes, who is a member of the FMLN, has pushed through reforms in the areas of health, education, and agriculture. The National Assembly elections will be crucial for deciding if El Salvador continues on the path of these reforms or whether the opposition parties will push through more conservative agendas, including further privatization and deregulation. Corey Fisher-Hoffman, FSRN, San Salvador.
While much of the world's focus is on Israeli and Iranian posturing over nuclear programs, Israel continues operations against alleged militants in Gaza. Today, an airstrike killed the leader of the Popular Resistance Committees. FSRN's Rami Almagari files this headline.
Rescue teams in Gaza say that two missiles hit a car, killing two people and injuring a third. The Popular Resistance Committees announced its leader, Zuhair al-Qaisi, and Mahmoud Hanani, a freed prisoner from the West Bank city of Nablus, died in the attack. Abu Mujahid, spokesperson for the Popular Resistance Committees, vowed retaliation.
By committing such a crime, the occupation has changed the rules of the game. Therefore, the occupation alone will have to face repercussions.
An Israeli army spokesperson confirmed the strike and said that al-Qaisi was planning an attack on Gaza-Israel border. The Popular Resistance Committees denied and described the claims as baseless. Rami Almighari, FSRN, Gaza.
Ohio Department of Natural Resources officials say a cluster of recent earthquakes in the northeastern part of the state were likely caused by hydrofracking disposal wells. As a result, the department announced new rules today regulating wastewater disposal. The regulations prohibit drilling disposal wells in certain types of geologic formations and the plugging of certain existing wells. Companies will be required to submit extensive geologic data before drilling and must install safety and monitoring equipment at the well sites. A judge has ordered New York City to pay millions of dollars in compensation to firefighters who charged the city used racially biased recruitment tests to keep African Americans and Latinos off the force. FSRN's Salim Rizvi has more.
U.S. District Judge Nicholas Goroff has chided the city for not correcting the recruitment anomaly as he delivered his judgment granting around $128 million in compensation. The lawsuit alleged that the city violated civil rights laws when it used an entrance exam the firefighters said was designed to racially discriminate. The New York judge also criticized the hiring practices of FDNY, calling them racially discriminatory. He ordered major reforms to be overseen by the court. FDNY will be required to hire 293 black and Latino applicants. City Attorney Michael Cardoza calls the judgment, quote, erroneous, and maintains that the FDNY works toward diversity. Many fire departments across the country face similar lawsuits. Salim Rizvi, FSR in New York City.
Federal funding for the Texas Women's Health Program is set to expire at the end of the month after the state legislature pushed Planned Parenthood out of the mix. Reproductive rights and health activists across Texas held demonstrations this week, and more are planned going forward. From San Antonio, Andrew Oxford reports for FSRN.
Don't mess with Texas women was a common slogan at demonstrations from San Antonio to Dallas, Austin to Abilene, as thousands of Texans turned out this week to protest cuts to the Women's Health Program. Launched in 2005 with Medicaid funding, more than 100,000 low-income Texas women are now enrolled to receive services such as birth control and cervical cancer screenings through the $40 million a year initiative. Governor Perry now aims to exclude Planned Parenthood from the program in a move the federal government says unlawfully restricts patient choice. With officials in Washington and Austin deadlocked on the issue, federal funding will end on March 31st. Governor Perry said Thursday he would fund the program with state dollars, but insisted that organizations affiliated with abortion providers would be excluded. Planned Parenthood, which provides more than 40% of the program's services, launched a 15-city bus tour this week to rally Texans against the cuts. More protests are planned at the state capitol and around Texas next week. Andrew Oxford, FSRN, San Antonio.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
This weekend marks 1 year since a massive earthquake hit Japan, sending a tsunami into coastal villages and killing an estimated 20,000 people. The event triggered the Fukushima nuclear disaster that displaced 340,000 residents. Despite Prime Minister Yoshihiko Noda's assurances that the emergency has been brought under control, many Japanese residents remain wary of the risks of nuclear power. 92% of Fukushima residents say the government has not done enough to rebuild the prefecture, according to a survey released this month. All but two of the country's 52 nuclear reactors remain shut down amid concerns about safety and oversight. In the U.S., dozens of Fukushima-style reactors have come under scrutiny. 100 similar reactors are nearing the end of their expected lifespan. Some of them are near population centers or in earthquake zones. All in all, 100 million Americans could be at risk in the event of a Fukushima-like disaster. That's according to a new documentary called Danger Zone: Aging Nuclear Reactors. The film takes a look at the Nuclear Regulatory Agency tasked with ensuring the safety of U.S. nuclear facilities. Joe Rubin is a producer and reporter with the Center for Investigative Reporting. He's also one of the producers, along with Serene Fang, of the documentary. Joe Rubin, welcome to FSRN.
It's really a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Begin by giving us an idea of how many of these aging plants we're talking about, and describe the relicensing process that's in place that's supposed to ensure safety.
Now, there's 104 plants in the United States, and for a lot of historic reasons, we haven't built plants in a long time. So all of them are either past 40 years or approaching 40 years. 71 of them have already gone through the 20-year license approval process. And originally, basically, it was thought that plants would only operate for 40 years, but that was really sort of the lifespan of a plant. But they've all gone, 71 have gone through that process, and none of them have been red flagged. They've all gone through it. And one of the reasons for that is that originally the idea behind relicensing was, well, if we're going to relicense these plants, it really needs to be like a stress test. We need to look very thoroughly at what's happening with the different components, how well are they aging. After Yankee Row, in fact, they found that the reactor was badly embrittled and dangerous, and so they shut it down. And so after that, the industry pushed back and really were able, through lobbying, to change the standards of relicensing.
That inspection you're talking about, Yankee Row, is in Massachusetts, right?
Yes.
We've been talking about the oversight of these plants and who's responsible. You speak with Gregory Yasko, the chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and his voice is featured in your documentary.
Our job is to make sure that plants are safe today, tomorrow, and every day that they have a license to operate. So if there's a problem with a particular facility, it's our job to make sure they address that problem now, not wait until license renewal.
That's Gregory Yasko, chair of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Joe Rubin, what about this safety process that he's describing?
Well, I think what Commissioner Yasko is saying there is he's saying, look, we relicense these plants, and we have a certain process that we go through. But basically, we have two inspectors in the plants at all times, and we're always on the job of safety. That would be the NRC's defense there, and that's what the commissioner is referring to. That makes a lot of sense on some levels, but then if you look at some incidents, like at the Davis-Bessey plant in Ohio in 2001, there was a leaking component, which was this was a known problem that the NRC was aware of, and it was leaking onto the top of the reactor, and again causing it to decay. And the utility there pushed back. The NRC, lower-level NRC staff, wanted to inspect it. The utility pushed back and was able to stop that until it was almost too late. They finally went in and inspected it, and they found that that it was within months of having a major accident. The inspection, I believe it was an internal NRC inspection, came back and said that it was, what could have eventually happened could have been somewhere between Three Mile Island and Chernobyl. Well, that's not exactly, comforting. So, I think that argument of, oh, well, we're doing a good job every day, you look at incidents like that, and it's worrisome.
And as we talk about inspections that the NRC carries out, it's important also to look at what exactly they entail and what they don't include. What is left out from these reviews?
Well, they don't do a stress test. They don't look at new earthquake information. They don't look at evacuation plans. In New York City, of course, people are incredibly concerned, including the governor, who his attorney general, I would say, has become almost a shadow NRC the number of times that they've had to sue the agency to have it step up its oversight. So, they don't look at some really fundamental questions there.
Well, you mentioned the role that the nuclear industry itself has, and that's been a concern that's been raised about its influence on the NRC as well in its inspections and its decision making.
Yeah, I mean that comes up again and again, including with and former NRC officials. It's not exactly a secret, and even when we visited the agency and we were just kind of chit-chatting before our interview with the commissioner, I mean, I noticed that everyone had been sort of in and out. Different people we spoke to, many of them had been in and out of the industry. There's probably a lot of expertise you can get within the industry, but there's some real problems with the way that the influence that the industry is having on regulatory decisions.
Joe Rubin is a producer and reporter with the Center for Investigative Reporting. He's also one of the producers, along with Serene Fang, of the documentary Danger Zone, Aging Nuclear Reactors. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, hey, thanks so much.
And you can find a link to the documentary on our website, fsrn.org. In the West Bank city of Ramallah, a new project aims to improve women's rights. Organizers have erected 12 billboards throughout the city to capture residents' attention and encourage reflection and discussion on gender issues and stereotypes. FSRN's Jillian Kessler-Damore has more.
Three women, hands clasped behind their heads, doing aerobics in the Gaza Strip. A Palestinian woman wearing boxing gloves, a poster of Oscar De La Hoya over her right shoulder. An elderly woman with deep lines running across her face. These photographs are prominently displayed on billboards in central Ramallah. Taken by five local women photographers, they are part of a new campaign called Ichna Minhon, or We Are From Here. Organizers say the project is meant to spark a debate around women's roles within Palestinian society and the challenges Palestinian women continue to face under both Israeli occupation and the patriarchal structure within their own society. Photographer Lucia Ahmed has been living in the West Bank for 7 years. Originally from France, she said that she hoped the billboards would open up more freedoms for women in the West Bank.
To allow people to take their freedom in the reality of it, their own space. This is our space. People say, free country, we are not in a free country, so this is a starting point to discuss. Let's talk.
But Ahmed says being able to freely take photographs for the project was a challenge.
We had a cop, we had a guy, and the guy told us, in Arabic, he told us, we don't have this kind of stuff here. And I just told him, Mabruk, you just get it, Allah. And you know, you just get it now, so be happy for what you got for your country. And we had a fight in the street, and in that it was totally the meaning of freedom.
Within Palestinian society, few openly discuss gender-based violence and discrimination. But recent surveys reveal a widespread problem. A 2009 report released by the Palestinian Women's Information and Media Center found that 77% of women in Gaza had experienced some form of violence. An earlier survey commissioned by the Palestinian Central Bureau of Statistics also found that almost 62% of married Palestinian women were exposed to psychological violence, 23% experienced physical violence, and almost 11% were exposed to sexual violence. Khitam Safin is the chairperson of the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees. She explained that oppression of Palestinian women stems from both the Israeli occupation and from traditional Palestinian society.
In arresting people, in confiscating land, in building settlements, in taking our water, using checkpoints, the siege of Gaza. The Palestinian women face these challenges strongly, but they have a big burden to hold. So this is the first challenge. The second challenge is the traditional society, which was considered and still considered as an obstacle towards full equality and dealing with women as equal people in the Palestinian society.
Although women make up roughly half of the Palestinian population, awareness of women's rights also remains low. Safin says it's critical that women, especially those living in poverty in remote areas, know about the resources available.
We try to reach them and to give them services for their children, for their awareness, for their vocational training. We try to bring to make them reach the resources for education, for economical resources.
A 2008 survey commissioned by the Ramallah-based Arab World for Research and Development Center found that nearly three-quarters of Palestinians did not know of any organization working on women's rights in the area. The same study found that 77% of respondents would support enacting laws to protect women from domestic violence. The Yechna Menhon billboards will be taken down on March 10th, shortly after International Women's Day. This year, Palestinians marked the day with demonstrations in solidarity with Hana al-Shalabi. Al-Shalabi is a Palestinian woman prisoner who has been on hunger strike for more than 20 days in protest of being held under an Israeli administrative detention order without charge or trial. Jillian Kessler-Damore, FSRN, Ramallah.
Thank you to Free Speech Radio News for bringing us those international headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at their website, fsrn.org. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. And that's a program for March 9th, 2012. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved with the show, or give us an important news tip, please contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca. You can also listen to our past interviews on the News 101 page on mixcloud.com. For more independent news, join us Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Iqbal Ahmed, and my co-host tonight was Claire Eagle. Today's show is produced by Chirag Mahajan. From the entire team at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Stranded.